When the man was murdered, the gallery was full of voyeurs. They'd come to see and be seen, to admire and be admired. In their finery, they'd postured and praised the artist, considering each canvas, looking carefully at every mark of the brush, discerning nuance and tone and meaning. They eyed each other as rivals in fashion and wit, in the sycophantic ability to recognise artistic genius. The show belonged to art and artists and art lovers, and so no one noticed the writer. When the body was discovered, there were screams of horror. Some sobbed on seeing the corpse. Others could barely contain their glee. The gallery staff soothed and apologised. Management called insurers. The authorities barked orders and asked questions. They listened for guilt, for motive and lies, and no one heard the writer. When the dead man was identified, many claimed intimacy. Some had worked with him, others had danced in his arms. Several people purported friendship. A few admitted to a mutual loathing. They offered opinions and insights, analyses of character, and yet no one knew the writer. On introductions, what if you wrote of someone writing of you? In the end, which of you would be real? In the beginning, she was a thought so unformed that he was aware only of something which once was not. And there was the idea, the embryonic notions of story, fragile, swirling mists that struggled to find patterns, sense that was made and unmade and made yet again. In time, there were shapes in the clouds. And there was her. They were shy with each other at first. Stiff. It took the longest time to exchange names. Many were considered and discarded until finally one was familiar. One rang true. She wrote books, quirky, whimsical mysteries with an eye for the absurd. Her pen was light and her voice assured. Even so, she had not been born with the knowledge that she would write, but happened upon storytelling accidentally, while seeking some unknown distraction. In writing, she found meaning and purpose, and a kind of spiritual joy, and like many who came late to religion, her devotion to the craft was absolute, her conviction in its power unshakable. Yet she hesitated before calling herself a writer, lest it seem presumptuous or affected or just plain silly. Some small part of her recoiled from claiming her place aloud too absolutely. Her work had achieved a modicum of success, though she was by no means a household name. He called her Madeline de Leon. Her husband would call her Maddie. She was 30 and, when they first came to know of one another, happy. Madeline was a lawyer. She had been a lawyer first. She practiced in the corporate sector. But she didn't like to talk of work or even think about work when her time was her own. "My concern is billable," she'd proclaim when asked about some matter she'd left at the office. "If I'm not being paid, I just don't care." But she'd married a man who cared all the time. Hugh Lamond was a doctor. Not just a doctor, but the doctor. Ashwood was not large enough or gentrified enough to have more than the doctor, and Hugh Lamond was it. Every man, woman and child in Ashwood knew who he was and assumed he cared about each small twinge or ache or concern, regardless of whether it was his anniversary or his wife's birthday. They were right. In the beginning, Madeline had thought it funny, the godlike status of the country doctor. And Hugh was, after all, charming and committed. If anyone deserved to be a small town god, it was him. Now it niggled just a little that she had been lost in his divine glory, a handmaiden to his social deity. But still, she was proud of him. So Madeline worked, commuting when she had to and advising from home when she could. In her non-billable hours, she painted and sewed and built a garden which would grow to be worthy of the grand home they would have when they got round to renovating. And then one day, while sitting in a particularly tedious meeting on some technical matter for which a lawyer's presence was merely decorative, Madeline de Leon had an idea for a story and the very first thought of him. The moment of genesis was strong, a cell of creativity that divided and multiplied until there was life. He had barely any substance at all, just a space in the narrative for a protagonist of some sort. She began writing then and there, raising her head occasionally to nod so her colleagues would think she was taking notes about the meeting itself. Every now and then she would arch a brow and shake her head or rub her chin while frowning or tap the table with her lips pressed tightly together. She called it her boardroom technique, the kind of lawyerly imitations of consideration that made people feel better regardless. It was Madeline's conviction that her clients demanded the presence of their lawyers at these meetings, not because they needed them or even planned to listen to them, but because the legal profession was a kind of security blanket. She was paid for what she called corporate handholding, and the nature of Madeline was such that she was not too proud to admit it. In that meeting, she discovered just one thing about him, but oh, what a thing! What a perfect link! He was a writer. It was their connection. He would see the world as she did, in stories or potential stories, in vignettes and themes. He would judge people as characters, each with their own story. They would look upon his world together. She called him Edward McGinnity. His friends would call him Ned. He was 28 when she found him, a young man with the world at his feet and no idea of how he should step into it. Edward McGinnity had always known he would write. It was as natural to him as breathing, and he suspected the consequences of stopping would be as dire. In his mind, there had always been epics, tales which carried on the books he could not bear to end, and new stories with conglomerate characters and modified plots. Eventually, he'd picked up a pen. At first, he'd written poetry, as adolescents do, learned to weave words with angst and defiance and heartbreak. Those old verses embarrassed him now, melodramatic, flowery, pretentious. But every so often there was one line, one phrase which was clear and strong and perfect. As he grew into a man, Edward McGinnity learnt to pull back, to leave the louder things unsaid, to call out to the whispers once drowned in waves of passionate literary excess. And he found new stories and a desire to be read.